Hype Man, Raj Nation, the GOAT, GOAT to Market. From Hype HQ in Chicago, Illinois, Startup Hype Man presents the GOAT to Market Show. What's up, everyone? I am your host, Raj Nation, the founder and chief pitch artist of Startup Hype Man. This podcast is where we bring you founders, company leaders, and creatives who are building it, who are doing it, who have been there and done that. And they pull back the curtain on their go-to-market strategies so that you can build a venture that you love and become the GOAT of your industry. Want first listen on episodes before anyone else? Subscribe to our newsletter at startuphypeman.com. You will get alerts every Sunday morning when we release new episodes. All right, let's hear how today's guest is becoming the GOAT.
Ladies and gentlemen, making her way to the microphone from Klang, Selangor, Malaysia, and currently residing in Chicago, Illinois. She is the co-founder and CEO of Cardio Diagnostics. Please welcome the Dr. Misha Dogan.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome. Thank you for being here, Misha. Excited to have you. As I mentioned, she is Misha Dogan, PhD, co-founder and CEO of Cardio Diagnostics. What is Cardio Diagnostics? Well, they believe that heart disease prevention rather than treatment should be the norm. And they empower you to take control of your heart health through their machine learning, AI, and DNA-based solutions. What's key in their technology is the ability to recognize and quantify risk for heart disease directly from your DNA from two perspectives. One, your genetics, and two, your lifestyle and environment, otherwise known as epigenetics. Now, in not that long, starting in May 2017, that's only 7 years ago, as of this recording, they have managed to, with only 10 employees, scale up to being a publicly traded company on the NASDAQ. They've done a lot in their journey, and specifically, what we're here to talk about today is expanding your TAM to increase your revenue. Misha, once again, welcome to the show. Why is this on your mind and why is this important to you?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. I think as any entrepreneur can share, and especially as the CEO, revenue is always top of mind. But one of the key things I think a lot of times we need to take a step back and do is not just think about our TAM, which is, I think, in a lot of ways, easier to calculate, easier to understand, but more importantly, think about ways we can get to that TAM and diversify the ways we get to the TAM so we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket.
We're going to dive a whole lot more into this as today's conversation unfolds, but first, let's learn a little bit more about Misha, the person. Now, Misha, I mentioned during your introduction, you grew up in Malaysia, far away a ways from the USA. Talk to me about what do you feel that growing up there and then coming here, what do you feel like, what lessons were you taught, or what did you take with you when you came to America?
It was exciting to move here about 16, almost 17 years ago. Think about 16 years ago, back in 2008. I moved here for school, so I knew what I was coming here for. But I was also 19 when I moved. So you're still young and you're still building your values and you're still figuring out who you are. So to me at that point, it was a new adventure, a new chapter. But I think I brought the most from my family, and I hate to say this because I think it stereotypes Asian families, but my family told me to make sure I go there, put my head down and study really hard and get good grades and focus on the task at hand. And so that really helped at least to focus and get what I was there done, but also be able to explore new things away from family that, you know, when you live with your parents and your family, it's just not as easy to explore and go out and do what you feel like doing or learning. So that was a fun time.
Well, and as we talk about going out and exploring and learning and doing, one of the things I found in my research was, so you went to the University of Iowa, and while you were there, you actually did a project where you conducted an analysis of the top party schools, specifically using Twitter data. Talk to us about how you came up with that idea for a project. Was it a group project, and what actually went into that?
It's funny that you bring that up. I don't even know the last time I thought about that. So when I was in college, one of the key areas that was, of course, up and coming was AI, machine learning, a lot of analytics side of things. And I can't remember the exact class name, but the project was to do something using sentiment analysis. So it was a pair. It was myself and another student. We got together and we wanted to understand what people's sentiments were around certain schools. And so we took Twitter feed and fed it to look at the types of words, and even feeds into now things like natural language processing to be able to understand what the sentiment is for each of those tweets around a certain school.
What did you find? So what was the top party school?
You know, I would love to say my memory's great, but it was one of those class projects, so I can't say I remember the results exactly. But if I recall correctly, University of Iowa is always known to be a top party school. and I think the university did live up to its name, if I recall correctly.
Were they satisfied with your findings then? Did they want that? Did they want their reputation?
Well, let's just say that it didn't go outside of the class. but I also think it's nice for the university to have that aura about it, where a lot of students, you know, when you're 19 and 20, there are other things in life that you're looking to explore, and being part of a party school sometimes is not that bad of a thing.
Exactly. Yep. All right. So you did a lot with data at that point in life, and that was pretty early on. And then years later, you end up co-founding a company that, you know, for all intents and purposes, also has a lot to do with data. So can you talk us through, maybe give us a quick recap of the journey that got you to starting Cardio Diagnostics in the first place? And then also, how did you come up with the idea for Cardio Diagnostics?
So understanding cardio would require us to go back 16 years ago, pretty much about 2 to 3 months into moving to Iowa. I found myself, believe it or not, again, my family said, go find yourself a job and start paying your bills. That's part of being an adult. And so I was looking for a position and I came across this research position. So I'd be a work study. And I learned about this fascinating field called epigenetics. I've never heard about it, never learned about it in high school. And this was my freshman year in college. And what it really taught me and really opened my eyes to was that complex diseases like heart disease actually largely comes from our lifestyle and environment. In fact, about 80% of it comes from our lifestyle and environment. And that's really what epigenetics captures at an objective level with our DNA biomarkers. And for me, that was very fascinating because I come from a family with 2 generations history of heart disease. So to come from a family and think you've seen 2 generations of your family members be affected by heart disease, it's just only going to propagate. To go from that thought process and mindset to now actually learning that it's largely within your lifestyle and control, and there's actually a way and mechanism for us to understand it, was absolutely fascinating. But to your point, what happened around 2010, 2011, after a few years in the world of epigenetics, it's a good thing that we started measuring it at scale. So for all intensive purposes, it became a data problem. Because for each individual, we were looking at millions of these biomarkers. And and in addition to that, we were also layering it with genetic markers. So it was a combination of billions of biomarkers for one person. And we needed a better way to understand what all of these biomarkers say about heart disease. And that was essentially my doctoral work, was to say, we understand the genetic markers, we understand the epigenetic markers really well. Now let's layer in AI and ML, because it's a tool that allows us to look at data at scale, but also look at patterns associated with heart disease. And that's really how I got into merging those three areas. One of the things I was not ready for, did not expect, was how well we were going to be able to capture heart disease using these three elements, genetics, epigenetics, and AI. And as a result, while I was still doing my PhD in 2016, we patented the technology and had to figure out if we wanted to turn it into something more than just a patent, which myself and Rob, my co-founder, were very invested in. And we decided to found Cardio in 2017.
So you start the company. I gave a brief overview in the introduction, but perhaps you could just enlighten everyone a little bit more on, you know, what exactly, you know, the offering is to the market and the product itself.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about heart disease, I want to use as context what we have done. For decades, actually since the 1940s, 1950s, heart disease has been the number one killer. And for as long as that, we have really looked at traditional ways of measuring and understanding heart disease. So things like lipids and hemoglobin A1Cs and different ways of measuring someone's risk, but also trying to understand how do we help this patient. What we found ourselves is a new paradigm. It was essentially a new way altogether using epigenetics. No one was really using it clinically, to now be able to measure these unique biomarkers that each of us walk around with on a day-to-day that we just don't see with our naked eyes, use that as a basis to understand whether we're at risk for a certain cardiovascular event or have heart disease that we don't know about, but more importantly, use these unique biomarkers to each of us to be able to say, where is this person's risk or signal coming from, so we can act on it in a more personalized manner to then treat or manage this person's heart disease. But more importantly, because epigenetics does change when you intervene, understand how well these interventions are working. So we really found ourselves in a space where we're able to address that cardiovascular care continuum from the start of assessing risk and detection to the middle of figuring out how can we personalize care, and then following up with information to monitor a specific patient. So for us, it was a new way of providing tools to clinicians and people who are addressing heart disease, but more importantly, also innovate when it comes to care delivery. Because one of the things that we did is we built this in the form of a blood test. And a blood sample can be drawn anywhere, any corner of the country, and can be scaled pretty quickly, both nationally and internationally. So it was a way for us to not just introduce something new, but also build it in a way where it can be used at scale and really think about precision medicine for what it is.
So with that understanding, let's dive into the main topic of today's conversation, which is expanding your TAM to increase revenue. If we go back to the start of Cardio Diagnostics, you know, as I think about a product like this, it seems to me that the customer in this case, aside from the patient, is going to be like the doctor or the hospital, right? What was your initial, you know, target market and what was the go-to-market strategy to get in front of them?
Yeah, that's a great point. One of the things in healthcare in general, and companies like us who are not just developing one element of our product. What I mean by that is we do the ML AI side, the analytical software, but we actually do design and develop the assays for the clinical tests themselves. So we do both sides of the coin. And just developing these clinical tests that are also validated pretty well from a scientific standpoint takes a number of years. So by the time we launched our first test, it wasn't until 2021. And to your point, a lot of times when we think about healthcare and healthcare delivery, the first place where we go to is providers and patients, right? Clinicians who are providing care to patients and patients who are in need for such care, which is great. But one of the things that we learned early on when we took that approach, which I think a lot of times tends to be the first approach, is providers have their levels of information and their needs and the due diligence they do for a buy-in. And early on, when we launched our test, it was great buy-in from providers. They were very excited about it. It was a new tool for them. It's a tool that they didn't have. It's a tool that provides insights that they can't get anywhere else. They were very excited. But one of the key things, and I think a lot of people who are building in healthcare can share this, is you will sooner rather than later run into a wall, because as much as a clinician or a provider is making clinical decisions, they are the buyer on the clinical side and the use and implementation side. They sometimes and often are not the economic buyer. The person who is going to pay for the test is not the provider. It's likely the provider organization, it's a health plan, it's an employer, it's a whole host of other people on the executive level who have buying capabilities beyond just the provider themselves, who are asking for the test and wanting the test. So while that was a great start, one of the things we learned early on with that go-to-market strategy is the user and the payer weren't the same person. And the user and the payer weren't at the table at the same time to have conversations related to their own needs and what they're looking for.
So let me repeat that. The user and the payer are not the same person, and the user and the payer are also not at the table at the same time. That creates a little bit of a fragmentation or maybe a bifurcation of a sales process or an acquisition process. So talk us through sort of like the ladder of your value props, and did you go top down or bottom up?
You'd have to do both. And that's what we did, right? So if we're thinking of a provider organization, we had to, for a lack of a better way of putting it, court the physician, because they understand the day-to-day and they understand their patients. They're seeing the problems and the needs of their patients firsthand. Again, day-to-day, day in, day out. And we also have to talk to the executives, whether it's the chief medical officer of a IDN or health system, whether it's the chief financial officer, people who are making decisions based on where are we spending money? Where are we saving money? Where are we seeing higher cost? Areas that are costing us more money. So one example I'll give you is, even within provider organizations, you have so many different flavors of provider organizations. You have concierge providers, you have large IDNs, you have rural community healthcare centers, you have risk-bearing organizations, you have retail healthcare. All of them make decisions differently. Or I should say a lot of them make decisions differently. In an example of a risk-bearing organization, they are a provider organization. However, their care, patient care, one, is important and top of mind, but they have another incentive. They're part of these risk contracts that they can make money off of and share in the savings if they are to meet certain metrics and certain measures that they have as part of their contract. And so for someone like that, and I'll use family medicine specialists, who's one of our customers, as an example, as a risk-bearing contract, they provide, as a risk-bearing organization, they provide great care for their patients, but they also happen to be the financial decision maker because they are the ones tied to the risk-bearing contract. But if you go to an IDN or a health system, the providers are the ones doing the day-to-day, and then you have the chief medical officers and chief financial officers who who are part of now a larger organization who have to come together and agree to pay for it or somehow adopt the test as well, in addition to the providers.
Okay, so this creates quite the complicated web.
Yes.
Can you share then, you know, that question started with, is it top down or bottom up? And you said both. So it's not only top down, bottom up, but it's all around as well. How did you establish, or what did you establish was the message that's going to work for one group versus not another? And then also, how did you get them ultimately at the same table if that's not where they're currently residing?
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. And to your point, everything is so intertwined, but they are disjointed. And that's the very fascinating part about what we have had to build through and learn and optimize and evolve over time. So I'll give you an employer organization, for instance. And the reason I say employer organizations, we talked about how when we think about go-to-market and a healthcare product, we think about clinicians and patients. However, about 56, 57% of us get our healthcare from our employers. And our employers now are able to make those decisions as to what kinds of benefits we get. It's no longer just the provider making the decisions as to I need to get tested for heart disease. It's also whether my employer has made a certain heart disease benefit available to me and other employees. So now you have the employer, the provider, the employee who's also the patient, whether or not they have a health plan involved. And now all of them are tied in some way, shape, or form. So using employer as an example, we go to the employers themselves. And I also want to, not to make this any more complicated, but we know that not all employers are equal. There are small employers, there are medium-sized employers, there are large employers, there are self-funded employers, there are employers who get their insurance through the usual Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Cigna, Aetna. So you have all of these different flavors. So for us, the segmentation then becomes more important. So instead of just saying, let's just go to all employers because, you know, 60% of us get our healthcare from our employers. For us instead, one of the key improvements that allowed us to scale was to be able to say, all right, within employers, if self-insured employers are the decision makers on what to deploy, and they're the payers because they're self-funded. Mm-hmm. Now we have them at the table at the same time. And in addition to them, they may have a broker partner, so a benefits broker, whether they're bringing them to the table. And the third element is, who's their provider? Is it someone in network? Do they have an in-house clinic that they use? Do they contract it out to someone else? And now we have the provider. So for us, it's about starting with a group like the employer, and it's starting with a group like the benefits brokers and bringing them together, understanding their needs and where their cost centers are, because heart disease, it tends to be either top three or top five when it comes to cost centers for employers, and then use that as a basis to understand how do they tend to implement testing and care for their employees? Is it, again, the on-site clinic? Is it a provider that they contract out? So we tend to go to all parties and then converge them together. But I do want to say, though, each of these parties are able to make decisions at different levels. So self-insured employers are able to make the decisions regardless of whether a broker is part of that or not. Because, again, they're deploying the tests, and they are paying for the test. So it just depends on the segments, and also why I think when you're thinking about your TAM, it's not just good practice to understand how you're going to get to your TAM. So it's not just to say, we're going to go to providers, we're going to go to employers, but to further break that down to say, you know, there's so many different kinds of providers, so many different kinds of employers. How do we break that down further to segments that we're likely to see more success sooner rather than later, and then work our way through that vertical.
So it really breaks down into finding the nuance within a single market. We can look at something and say, oh, you know, we serve healthcare, but that's the 101 version of looking at it. You have to get to the level 500 course, if you will, where you can really break it down into specific sort of aspects. And as I think about that, one way you can really, and for everyone listening, one way you can really get into the nuance of who your market is by having the right software and tools at hand to be able to message to them. And one of the things that I've been using recently that I'm really excited about is ActiveCampaign. And I switched over from ActiveCampaign. I used to use MailChimp, and I'm so happy because I dropped the chimp and I got the goat, if you will. ActiveCampaign is the goat of marketing automation, because whether you are a B2B SaaS, a marketplace, a consumer app, or really anything in between, the reality is every kind of business needs a newsletter. And your newsletter can do a lot for you if you use it the right way. You can, in fact, segment out and message, you know, give one message to one group of people on your list and another message to a different group of people on your list. And I'll tell you, having used ActiveCampaign for about 2 months now, from setup to send, every newsletter we have published has been a 10x easier experience since we did switch to ActiveCampaign. There's tons of integrations. The automations are really simple. It's super easy to even like add in your, you can even like house your deal, your pipeline inside of ActiveCampaign as well. So you don't have to go across multiple softwares. And I don't know if it's the best or one of the best things is there's actually supportive customer support along the way. So it's not like an annoying chatbot. You actually get to talk to people who will help you. And I'll tell you, I was a MailChimp customer for probably a decade. And I finally made the switch and I no longer feel restricted. I feel enabled by my marketing automation software and what I'm able to do through email and everything else with ActiveCampaign. Not to mention, I'll tell you the biggest like hurdle I always think about when it comes to switching softwares is like, oh, I have so much stored in this old thing. I don't even want to take on the burden of like figuring out how to get everything in the new thing. ActiveCampaign made the data migration from MailChimp so quick and easy. I'm not kidding. I had to ask multiple times what more I was supposed to do along the way, because it really was that painless. And they kept replying like, no, you're good. We've got it covered. So whether you're on MailChimp, whether you're using HubSpot or any of the other ones, or if you don't even have one yet, you want to start using ActiveCampaign, and you can get your free 2-week trial by heading to the link inside of this episode description. You'll get a 2-week trial of ActiveCampaign. And you're going to like the pricing structure after that as well. And you can get access to that 2-week trial specifically by clicking the link inside of this episode description. Now, Misha, coming back to our conversation and that idea of how you're segmenting your market, one of the challenges with that level of segmentation is staying on top of the segmentation and the diversifying, right? So how have you approached, let me put it a different way. It's hard enough to message one thing to one target audience. How have you managed to stay on top of 5-6-ish different stakeholder groups and not get sort of like buried or just like, you know, caught out of pocket because there's just too much to do? Can you talk us through what like that org structure and messaging structure has been like?
Yeah. You know, we'd love to think ourselves largely as a tech company as well. And we always tell our team that software is there to 10x what we do on a day-to-day basis, especially if you're repeating something over and over again. So one of the things that we tend to do is layer in things that are scalable with ones that are not scalable. So when we're thinking about healthcare, a lot of times, you know, the face-to-face interaction and just meeting people in person, showing them a demo, getting their feedback or their pushback or you know, anything that they want to share in person is always great. But one of the things we know is you just can't meet all the providers, all the employers, everyone in person. So we tend to layer things like events, which again is not as scalable, with things like software, where we run digital campaigns, whether it's LinkedIn-based or any other software-based campaigns that allows us to reach these verticals and segments at scale. And then based on feedback and based on open rate and based on things like how quickly people are responding, how interested they are, we're then able to optimize. One, did that messaging work? Did it resonate? If we're not seeing people respond as much as we've seen in other campaigns, is it not a priority for them? So it just gives us data points to then improve our automation and software to be able to either change the way we're messaging or change the vertical or try a new segment within a vertical. So in any case, data then becomes extremely key because your software is only going to do what you tell it to do. You always have to reiterate on the domain and the information you're providing.
If we dig into the data a little bit more, what specific indicators or metrics are you looking at in those campaigns to say, hey, this approach we've been running, this campaign, this message, this whatever, this target group, it's working?
We tend to run at least campaigns initial when we kick off to a new segment. We don't quite have data yet. It's brand new that we're trying to figure out. We tend to run it for a couple of weeks to understand things like open rate, how many people are opting out, how many people are responding, and how quickly they're responding to us. And we've seen stark difference when a messaging resonates and it does not resonate. When it resonates, we tend to hear back from people within 2 to 3 business days. There are times where when messaging does not resonate, it could run for 3 or 4 weeks, a digital campaign, and we barely have one response. And part of the reason I start with messaging is because when we have used that data point or that hypothesis to optimize and iterate, we then do see improvement, because it's not hard for us to look at publicly available data, industry level data, to say heart disease is a cost center for employers. Heart disease is a problem for risk bearing organizations. It's easy to find those data points to help narrow down your segments, but it's not as easy to figure out what's resonating with them and what's making them act. So I would say one is the number of campaigns that you run, which segmentations you pick, and then being able to iterate on your messaging and looking into numbers like how quickly are people responding, what percentage of your group is responding. And here's the thing I would say, sometimes the number of responses can be a little deceiving. And the reason I say that is, you know, if you're sending a message to 10,000 people and 2 of them are the largest organizations that are responding to you, 2 out of 10,000 may seem pretty low, but they're really high value leads. They're really high value opportunities. Mm-hmm. So we also tend to look at who these organizations are, how big they are, and what kind of value they're likely to bring. And that data point is also important, because if it's a small employer with, you know, 20 employees and us, you know, selling them 20 tests is not as impactful from a revenue standpoint than maybe one employer that has, you know, 100,000 employees. So it's also relative to who you're reaching out to and the kinds of people who are responding to you. And then beyond that, we look at, you know, how quickly it takes us to get to consecutive meeting, and then how quickly we can bring those decision makers, whether they're user decision makers or buyer decision makers. And then on the flip side, how long it's taking us, of course, to close a contract. And I'll give you an example, for instance. So Vizient is the largest group purchasing organization in the country. They have 60% of IDNs and health systems on contract and 97% of academic medical centers. And we got a contract with them effective November of this past year. But we started the process of engaging Vizient August the prior year. So over a year, but the impact, you know, them being the largest group purchasing organizations organization, and Cardio now being on contract with 60% of IDNs and health systems and 97% of academic medical centers. That's huge. Imagine if we had to get our sales force to go out to 60% of IDNs and health systems and 97% of academic medical centers one at a time, right? So it's also about thinking creatively about aggregators of different groups and verticals that you're working in.
There's a couple of thoughts I've got on what you just shared, but before I go into that, I want to just take a moment here and let our listeners know, like, you can draw all these people to the table. The product ultimately has to back it up. And in Cardio Diagnostics case, it's an AI ML product. And if you, person who's listening to this right now, if you are building an AI ML product, you need a good software development partner. And that's where my friends at Akeba come in. They're here to help you go from 0 to 1 and 1 to 100 and every number in between and beyond. And whether that is AI and ML, or whether it's blockchain or no chain, or whether it's Web3 or Web2, a mobile app or a SaaS, any of those things, Akeba builds it at startup speed and enterprise level refinement. And they can do that because they've got the experience in the game, working with tons of startups like Stride Health, Aveno, Olive, Side, and many more, but also working with enterprise companies like T-Mobile. So they're able to take what they know at the enterprise level and bring those learnings down to the startup level so that whatever you are getting built for you is not being built on a house of cards. It's a stable foundation of code. And from your first dollar all the way to your $1 billion valuation, they are ready to help you, as they have helped so many others become not just go to market, but become the goat to market. The last three startups I've sent over Akeba, the last several startups I've sent over to Akeba's way have been so grateful that that introduction and connection has been made. And they have a really good offer for you, and it's called a You Call It Code Review. What is that? Well, they're gonna take a look at you, and if you qualify, they will review the most critical parts of your code so you can see exactly what your tech would need to launch or scale. And they'll do this completely free. And then we call it a You Call It because you call it from there. Do you want to handle things on your own because you have the knowledge? You call it. Do you want to get Akeba's help with developing that thing? You call it. Do you want to take it somewhere else? You call it. It's a You Call It code review. No one else on the market offers this, and I want you to take advantage of it. And if you're ready for a You Call It code review, head to akeva.io. That's akeva.io, akeva.io. Fill out the form and tell them Startup Hype Man sent you. Today on the Goat to Market show, we are with Misha Dogan, the co-founder and CEO of Cardio Diagnostics. And before the break there, Misha, we were talking about sort of this this challenge or how you've really been able to take on servicing these different layers of the market. You talked about in getting in front of them, you talked about sort of the messaging strategy, the campaign strategy, and you mentioned there's a stark difference in getting responses in 2 to 3 days versus getting a response rarely. And then also, like, what kind of a response and who is the respondent and how do they fit into your different ICPs? What I want to emphasize here is the question that I had asked then was around, what's the lead indicator or the metric you're looking at? And what you're looking at is responses. And I like hearing that because that's not a fickle metric. And I think a lot of times the metric people look at is clicks or quote unquote impressions or exposure. Right out of the gate, you didn't talk about anything. You didn't say, oh, well, we know X number of clicks equals, you said, we're looking at responses. And that's really smart. And I think it's something that a lot more teams and startup teams should be focusing on is, if someone responds, that's a good indication that it resonates. If someone clicks and doesn't do anything, it's more of a vanity metric and it doesn't necessarily indicate the right thing for you. So as you look at the response rates, and you were talking about how you even had deals like the one you mentioned that lasted a full year. What are you doing in the meantime? Because like that deal that comes in November of 2023 that you started in August of 2022, I'm assuming it's a massive deal, right? Huge. Mm-hmm. But you can't float the company on maybe they're going to sign 13 months from now. So
Are you couching that with enough smaller companies where the deal cycle is faster? Talk us through that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the name of the game when it comes to go-to-market is diversification. You have to diversify, because if you put all of your eggs in one basket and said, I'm just going to go after this one customer, as soon as I get them, I'm done. Said no one ever, right? No one's done. That's just the first one. The goal is to get more and more. So for us, it's about layering our segments. So I talked about our digital campaigns. We're always running digital campaigns across many verticals, across many subsegments within that vertical. So within an employer, we'd be running brokers, we'd be running small employers, someone who can make a decision in the next 30 or 60 days, or a large employer who, again, the value from that contract would be much higher, but they tend to take longer to make that decision. Or a regional broker who, again, smaller, 60 to 90 days, versus a large broker that could take upwards of, like Vizient, a year and a half. So for us, it's always about diversifying and layering. And one of the easier way to do that is, again, to kick off digital campaigns that you can do at scale. It'll be running in the background. And one of the things we implement in the company, despite how small we are, is something called DRI, so directly responsible individual. And the idea behind DRI is there is one person who is in charge of a specific vertical where they are focused heavily on ensuring everything's optimized, everything's running. However, we do have an integrated revenue team. So our sales, marketing, and customer success is part of just one team called the revenue team. And they do get feedback and they have dependencies from others on the team, but they tend to be directly responsible to ensure every element of a certain campaign or a certain vertical is going well. So that allows them to focus on and launch many different things and then triage the responses as they come in. And we tend to, largely, if you're thinking about it, we focus on providers, we focus on employers, we focus on correctional facilities, we focus on health plans, and these are pretty large segments. And within that, we break it down into subsegments that people then follow up and make sure that we are heading in the right direction, things are running well, and it's a well-oiled machine.
DRI, directly responsible individual. I have so many more questions I would love to ask, but we're running out of time. So let's head to our wrap up. First off, Misha, where can our listeners find you and learn more?
I would say LinkedIn would be the best place to find me. And if they would love to hear and learn more about CardioDiagnostics, we're at cardiodiagnosticsinc.com.
And we'll drop her LinkedIn profile URL in the episode description. Misha, through your journey, who is one person you want to shout out who's been helpful to you?
Wow. Picking one person is always hard, isn't it? I will say, actually, it's my husband. His name is Tim. And funny enough, Tim and I were, we went to school together all the way from undergrad. But when we were doing our doctoral work together, he actually told me about the first AI class that was going to be happening at the University of Iowa, and we both took it together. That was my venture into the AI world. When 2016, when we filed the patents and we were thinking, should we found CardioDiagnostics or not, he was a huge support and encouragement there. And a lot of people don't know this, but he came on as employee number one at Cardio. Because when you don't have much money to pay anyone, you want people who, would love the company and what you're doing as much as you do. And I was just so lucky to have him agree to come on as employee number one. And he's now our chief technology officer.
Amazing. Amazing that a recommendation to take an AI class in college was, largely, if not, the responsible act that led you to where you are today. Now, we'll next go through and give our respective top one or two lessons or takeaways for the listeners based on our discussion today. I'll go first and I'll toss it over to you. We really did cover a lot
And there's a lot of note taking I did, but I think the one thing I want to pull out as a takeaway for everyone listening is what we mentioned probably 10 or so minutes ago was, don't just think of your TAM as an aggregate number. Understand the nuance within it and the people that actually make up the TAM. Misha, top one or two lessons for the listeners.
I would say it's always a good process and strategy to take a step back to understand how you can get to your TAM, not just who they are. Mm-hmm. And drill that down as much as you can, because that may lead to more diversification in your go-to-market, more nuances and more creative ideas that you may or just may not be apparent from the get-go. The other thing I will share when it comes to go-to-market, a quick no is a win. If someone tells you no in the first 2 days, that's fine. That's a win. You'd rather them tell you no in the first 2 days than tell you no a year later. So be okay with that. Learn to use data and iterate to reduce the number of no's.
My final question, which is how we end every episode on this show. Fill in the blank, Misha. Entrepreneurship is blank.
To me, entrepreneurship is the journey where you will very quickly learn how far you can be stretched and how much you are willing to stretch.
The journey where you quickly learn how far you will stretch and
how far you can be stretched and how far you're willing to stretch yourself.
How far you can be stretched and how far you're willing to be stretched. Love it. She is Misha Dogan. Misha, thank you so much for joining us on Startup Hype Man's Goat to Market show today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And for everyone listening, did you have questions that bubbled up as you were listening back to this, but you're like, I can't talk to her. I'm not interviewing her in the moment. Join us for the podcast after party. That's right. We do an Ask Me Anything with our guests every week. And so Misha will be hopping inside of our Goat to Market Club. That's our online founder community that is totally free to join. And she'll be doing an Ask Me Anything all week the week this episode airs. So hop on in there, ask her your questions, and she will be answering those in our after party. It's the podcast AMA going on the whole week that this episode initially airs. We will catch you next time on I should probably tell you as well to get in on that. The URL is startuphypeman.com/GTM-club. startuphypeman.com/GTM-club. That does it for this episode, but we will catch you next week on Startup Hype Man's Goat to Market show. That'll put a bow on this one. Before we head out of here, a couple quick housekeeping items. Number one, did you like what you heard? Well, give us a subscribe and a follow. Maybe share it with one friend who you think would find this valuable. Number two, remember that Ask Me Anything I told you about at the end of the episode? That goes down exclusively inside of Goat to Market Club, our online founder and startup community. And you can access it for free. Your membership is 100% free at startuphypeman.com/GTM-club. Number three, need pitch help? Startup Hype Man is your man. Whether it's a fundraising narrative or a go-to-market or category narrative, we've got you covered to make sure you have messaging that doesn't help you just go to market, but of course, what? Helps you become the goat to market. All right, we will see you next week here on the Goat to Market show. Thank you for listening. And remember, why be a unicorn when you can be the goat?